Jaeger, everyone.
Jaeger. Welcome to the minute 29 Awake Life of Yogananda podcast, minute by minute. And with us today, Priyank and Mike are the usual suspects, myself. We have our dear friend Josh. Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Do you want to give us a short introduction? How do you know the team?
We met through the YAS group. We've been getting to know each other over the course of the great pandemic. Mike and I ushered together, and Priyank has helped with organizing some of the meetings and stuff. So we got to talk a little bit. So it's kind of how we came to know each other.
That's good. Yeah, great to have you on board. You usually ask the questions of how you came to know Yogananda. So maybe you could tell us how long have you been on the path with us?
It's always a weird question for me because my parents are both devotees. So I can say I'm fortunate. And I will say I'm very fortunate in that respect. They've been meditating, they've been studying, they were on the path before I was born, I'm pretty sure. Or at least it was close. Like they became Kriyabans either shortly after I was born or shortly before, not really sure which. And we were living in Seattle, but we moved to Phoenix when I was about 5. And so Phoenix has the Phoenix Temple. And that's where I started to become kind of aware of SRF because, you know, before then we didn't go to any SRF church or anything. So I can remember being 5, being at the Phoenix Temple. And my dad says that he went there when we first moved and talked to Brother Dharmananda, who was the head monk at the Phoenix Temple at the time. And he just thought he was some guy who told people where to cut the grass. That's his story anyway. He didn't realize, I guess Brother Dharmananda was the head monk. I know of several people whose parents were devotees, and they don't necessarily stick around, you know, and some people move on from SRF, some people stick around, and you know, others don't. Some of the reasons that I've heard why somebody might move on is they say, oh, I just feel like it was handed to me, you know, and so I have to learn on my own. But for me, it wasn't like that. I did my own soul searching. And you know, SRF has this way, like when you go to the church, you go to the Phoenix Temple and you see people, has this way of kind of, I think, I don't want to say cutting a groove, but it definitely makes an impression on you, you know? And so I just took some time when I was a teenager and I just kind of explored my own inner philosophies and, you know, talked to other people, and just with everything I've said, with everything I've seen and explored, I was like, no, this is the path for me.
Awesome. I suppose before you incarnated, you were quite aware of choosing this sort of path, right? So, you know, it's great to find your way again in this reality. So lovely.
You know, who knows? But I like to think that way because it makes me feel like more driven, you know, more, but who knows? it's all just speculation.
So where in the world are you at the minute,
Josh? I'm in Tallahassee, Florida.
Tallahassee, Florida. Okay.
Yeah, I moved out here about 4 years ago to go to law school and graduated law school. Now I'm working as a staff attorney at the trial court out here. I work with a bunch of judges and I draft orders for them and I write and stuff. I don't know what else to say about that.
Oh, very, very cool. I wasn't sure, given the being born, raised in Phoenix, you experienced the beautiful, beautiful temple over there and all your East Coast. So we're covering, I like to kind of map it up. We're covering lots of geographies here on this, this podcast.
So yeah.
It's good, good to see people from all over the world. And what's it like in Florida then with the SRF scene?
Well, it depends on where you go, but Tampa, I think, has a little bit larger of a center. If you go up to Atlanta, which is like a 4-hour drive from here up in Georgia, they have a really sizable center, and it kind of reminds me of the Phoenix Temple. Phoenix Temple is pretty quaint. and there's a solid group of devotees that come, and it's actually really special because you go there and you see you know, everybody that you know every week, and it's a tight-knit community. So the fellowship is really strong, but it's also very welcoming. It's not like exclusive to other people. So that's what I really loved about the Phoenix Temple. And Atlanta Center has got it. Now in Tallahassee, we have a circle. And so it's really, there's like five hardcore members who are coming regularly. And that's been kind of put on hiatus because of the pandemic. So I haven't really been meeting as much. But the person who heads it up out here, his name is Gary, and he has been doing this since the 1970s about, and has been going to convocation every year, has been every Sunday organizing these. And he is just, he's so awesome to know on a personal level, because he has so many stories. He's got so much experience with the monks and the nuns, and so much, I guess, knowledge about about their personal lives and their stories. So there's always just a wealth of really inspirational stuff coming from that guy. And also he's really devoted and made the path his own as well. So he's great to have, you know, to talk to and stuff. And yeah.
Very good. Shout out to Gary. Let's get on the podcast.
Yeah. Shout out to Gary.
Yeah. That's great. It's awesome to hear. Thanks for sharing. And you've seen the Awake documentary, I presume. When did you first watch it?
I watched it for the first time in Sedona, Arizona, at the, I guess we call it the premiere. Me and a bunch of devotees drove up from Phoenix, and they had this stadium. We all watched it there together. And then we kind of went hiking and stuff. I don't know. It was cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
And is it something you've watched repeatedly? Like, have you seen it once?
Yes. Yeah. I haven't, you know, to be honest, I haven't watched it in a while, because I've watched it so many times, but I would watch it a lot. I watched it I would watch it when it was on Netflix. I'd watch it like every day after work for a while. And so it gets, So I've seen it quite a few times. And then I bought it on YouTube as well, which is great. So you can just, you know, click and switch through, and that's kind of how I was able to get to the minute. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we'll enjoy having you on the show. Yeah. Priyank, Mike, you know, good to see you guys. I haven't said hello. How are you? You both good?
Yeah, I'm good. I love how Josh just like brushed across that. I was meeting the resident monk at Phoenix Temple. You know, 99.9% of the centers are out there. We don't have resident monks. So like for you, it's just like, oh yeah, you know, the monk, we can go speak to him. For the rest of us poor folk, we have to make do with convocation and like there's other things to see our monks. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really fortunate, and I got to go to BYP a couple of times, and Brother Dharmananda was there.
Oh, really? I was there too.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's quite the experience.
In Camp Arbolado.
Sorry, what's BYP?
It's
the boys' youth program. They have it in summers. They'll do like a week out there for the boys and a week for the girls. And you know, you just kind of, you get to go hiking. You get to do meditations in the morning and at night, and just do a bunch of kind of outdoorsy activities and stuff.
Well, they'll now need to do a gender neutral youth program, like GM.
Oh God, let's stop here.
Stop that.
I gotta look at my old photos and see if I can spot you there somewhere.
I don't know. It'd be probably like what, 95, 96. So
yeah, that's about the time I was there too. Yeah.
Oh really?
There you go. And you were ushering together years later.
Right? Yeah, that's
cool. And then podcasting years later after that.
Podcasting. Yeah.
Who knows what the next step is together?
Yeah. Epic. Well, good. It's great to have you on the show. This minute we delve into it. It's a really, really fun, cool minute. And lots of content to kind of pull apart. And I think really continuing from minute 28, you know, we were looking at Yogananda's you know, landing into the East Coast into Boston and his life there. And now we're going to look at more of the transition into the LA change that he's had. So cover a bit of the journey on the path that he took there, literally the path that he took there. We can delve into it. So there's lots of nice content in this minute that's been put together, really video footage from like the 1920s, lots of crowds of people who are, you know, busying themselves, dressed very, very well in true classic 1920s style. So, you know, the women in dresses and the men in suits. So it's given us a very nice feel for what it was like for Yogananda coming into that world at that time, in stark contrast really to the life he had in India. But he was going to be somewhat used to it by now, being in Boston for a few years. We see just, you know, the Asian culture influence coming through in these scenes, some video footage of, you know, a man and a woman, Asian man and woman, I'm guessing they're Chinese, are dancing together in very nice, you know, Asian garb. And there's the idea being given to us that, you know, there's a big influence of Asian culture in the West Coast that hadn't really taken hold in places like Boston on the East Coast. And we have a few different speakers here in this minute. So we have our good friend Varun Sunny, who was on the podcast earlier on, going back some months ago now. Felicia Tomasco, who's the editor of LA Yoga Magazine. Stephanie Simon, if I'm pronouncing that right. She's the journalist and author of, she is a journalist, and she's the author of The Subtle Body. Vidal, our good friend Masvidal, is in this minute as well. So they all have parts to play. So it's quite an action-packed little minute. And really, I think a good place for us to start off with is why LA? You know, why did Yogananda cover this? Because the people that we have in this minute talk a little bit about this, and they give us all the hints and tips we need. But guys, like, why do you think LA? You know, Mike, you're over in LA. Why don't we start with you? Why did you go to LA, Mike? Why do you think Yogananda was drawn to LA?
I mean, now it's easier to make that choice, right? Especially if you're into SRF, because it's just a lot of the SRF venues and a lot of the devotees, a lot of the communities here now. Back in the day, I mean, we talked about this in the last episode, that he was in Boston first, and at some point he figured out that this ain't it, this is not the place to start this organization. And at LA back then, we talked about this as well, right? It was not what it is today. It wasn't America's second largest city. It was small. It had a reputation. There were like people going there for the gold rush in the 1849, there was oil there, there was Hollywood there, but it was a small operation at the time. But he must have sensed that people are more receptive to his teachings in that place. And like you said, there was more Asian influence because of a lot of Chinese immigrants at the time. And also later on, I mean, you just have to see how exponentially his amount of devotees grew once he was in LA. I mean, so he definitely made the right choice when he went there.
And well, actually, Josh, I'll come to you next. Have you been to LA? You know, what's your view on it personally? And you know, why do you think Yogananda chose back in the early 1920s to go there?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mike hit on a lot, and just the fact that, you know, the rest of, well, there was probably some intuition that played a big part of it. In fact, we know that from some of the stories that we have about founding of Mother Center and how he just kind of pulled up and he had been having visions about that place. But without getting into the phenomena of it, more or less talking about the landscape of maybe seeing a better place to start an organization, Priyank brought up the map of where Guruji went when he got here. So he covered a lot of ground and probably experienced a lot and could see the variation in the cultures, because America varies a lot, or the US, I should say, varies a lot from state to state. And so you get to a place like California, and it could be vastly different from Massachusetts, vastly different. And so he's probably seeing the people out there, seeing that the fact that, you know, you have just a totally different scene. I think you have Hollywood playing a big role in it. There's a lot more interest in and things that are maybe different and trying out new things. So I think the openness was just ripe, and Guruji perceived it. And so, and also, like you said, it wasn't as well developed. And so you probably had a perspective of, you know, there's room to grow here. And so you could settle something that will be central in a city now, or it's not, maybe it's on the periphery of the city, but it will be central years from now. And so that was exactly what happened.
And we see in a minute, you know, Varun and Sonny coming in to say LA was a new frontier, a place of possibility. So, you know, exactly what, as you guys described it there, in a way that it wasn't really in the East Coast because of the Asian influence. So, yeah, spot on. And Felicia Tomasco is saying here that, you know, people come to Los Angeles often looking for something. I want to get into that in a separate conversation to a little degree, but Prank, is this from what you've read different material, you know, what's your take on this?
Yeah, so I'm now becoming an expert of Phil Goldberg's biography. I'm using it so much for this podcast. But personally, when I went to LA, I recently went just for convocation, and then I did the West to East Coast route, the opposite of what Yogananda did on the road. And in comparing like all those other states to LA, spiritually, I think there's some significance there. I'll read Phil Goldberg's what he wrote about LA. He wrote, it was Tinseltown, where minds were said to be as superficial as a Hollywood smile, where occultists and psychics were celebrities, where where any self-improvement fad could find a gullible audience, and new religions popped up as predictably as orange blossoms. But the La La Land, as it was called, vibe that some saw was flaky and others recognized as a spirit of openness and experimentation. It was a place where people reinvented themselves and valued spiritual creativity as much as the artistic variety, where the ideas of East Coast sophisticates dismissed as bizarre and heartland preachers denounced as heathen were given a shot. Yogananda must have sensed all of that when he dubbed LA the Benares of America, apparently, and that's quoted, so he must have written that somewhere. He perceived something in the city's character that set it apart as a destination for explorers of the soul. It seemed like an ideal home base for someone propagating a body of knowledge that was at once venerable and brand new. Swami Vivekananda and other Eastern teachers had been warmly received in Southern California. The Hollywood Vedanta Society would not open for another 4 years, but Ramakrishna monk named Swami Paramananda had found the Ananda Ashram in 1923, and Yogananda enjoyed his company over the years. So yeah, so it would appear that it does seem to be like a quite nice fertile ground for for this stuff, and people had already gone there, and he would have no doubt have spoken to people as well.
Mm-hmm. The way it was described by Felicia, was there was already a mind of the seeker there, mm-hmm. right? So it goes to what you were saying quite nicely there. But, you know, what is, Priyanka, I'll come back to you now, what is the idea of a seeker? You know, what does that mean to you, to seek?
There's a few elements. Obviously, we're primarily focused on the spiritual seeking, seeking solutions or answers to that which is unknown to you, or that which is shrouded in mystery, or that which is bugging you, you know, for years perhaps. So there's that element, which is obviously important to us, but that also equally applies to people that are just, you know, seeking something more, you know, like when for example, when I was a teenager, the thing to do was just to go out and get drunk and like you know, have fun as but that's just, it was so fleeting. Even though I wasn't looking for anything spiritual, I was seeking something more than that. And so there's that element. So I think if the ultimate seeking is this path of spirituality, but it sometimes starts off on this, in this like mundane or material way of just getting away from things that are just temporary or causing you disturbance, or, you know, simple things like that. I think Josh has got a lot of, he's eager to speak. Go on, Josh.
I didn't know. Okay. I mean, I totally agree with all this, and everything you read kind of reflects on that. There was a lot of people looking for maybe superficial kinds of things, like psychics and people who, fortune tellers, and Yogananda came with something that had so much more depth. You know, I think one of his famous quotes is, "Yoga is not crystal gazing." And he talks about more of the depth, and he gives people who maybe are seeking and kind of only hitting these kind of superficial, not so representative ideas of yoga and the yoga philosophy and things like that. And he gives something that has more substance behind it. And you see, I mean, over the turn of the 20th century, you had a lot of people coming from the East. And it was just, I think, because people here are also trying to kind of reconceptualize themselves and reevaluate the lives that they've been living. And so they're, you know, you need help when you're going to do stuff like that. You need somebody who can act as a guide. And so Guruji came at the perfect time, and he found the people who were just ripe in their curiosity. And so I mean, just kind of the perfect jumping off point for society at that point to grow.
Mike, is that why you went to LA? Are you seeking?
I think it's very different now. I think back in the day, you have to imagine the United States as very Northeast centric. So a huge amount of the population lived just up in that Northeastern Boston, New York, DC area. And people started moving to the rest of the country, like Josh said, during the 20th century. And LA early on started to, like first Chicago, I guess, and then later LA, was this kind of center of, I would say, energy, but you could say it became an economic center quickly. It became a center of media attention quickly because of Hollywood. But it didn't have all the rules that were set in the Northeast. Like, you know, in on the West Coast, you could get away with pretty much anything in the beginning, right? And so if you were somebody who said, I'm trying to manifest my life, but it's just not working out, why not try over there, right? It's like a fresh start, second chance kind of place. And that's what also, when Masvidal says a new frontier, I think that's what he means. It was that for a lot of people. And for Yogananda, it was a perfect environment to grow his church and his organization.
I love this because there's, you know, different perspectives coming in here, and it's really nice to hear. Whenever I think about this, I immediately think about the gold rush. You know, it was 1848. There was a big gold rush to the West Coast, and this was the new frontier. People really having to go across this vast kind of spread of land, with a lot of confrontation. Obviously, we know this with the Native Indians, Indian peoples, and things like this. So it was very, very harsh time. And that wasn't that long before Yogananda landed there. 70 years is really not that long. So this would have really been in the minds of the people, just this sheer adventure and exploration. And I know I Googled this earlier on, some stats here, and I love my odd bit of stats. There was 1,000 residents in the city of LA back in 1821, 600,000 by 1925, and 4 million today. It's just this massive expanse of, you know, growing population. And it would have been peoples coming from, you know, Ireland, you know, European countries, kind of coming into the East Coast, getting persecuted, and all the wars going on. And so this would have been like a paradise, kind of coming into sunshine all year round and everything in LA. So, you know, it really would have seemed quite like a paradise to people. And Yogananda coming there really is, as you said, Josh, timely, right? Coming out of the Yuga period, coming into a time of seeking new knowledge and truth, you know, people seeking truth, and you're going to have to give that to them, right? And we touch on it actually later on in the minutes, and how you're going to have to give people a more personal relationship with God. And that's beautiful, isn't it? That's what people are really trying to seek, not this sort of sense of worshiping God from afar through maybe some Christian texts at the time. So awesome. I love it. And there was something, again, Josh, you mentioned about Jürgen prophesizing, and that's what I wanted to touch on next, if I can. There's a few times, few instances in the autobiography of a yogi where this actually was documented, was talked about. And we can read a couple short passages in here. We have on saved on our Trello. Do you guys want to read out one or two? Mike, do you want to bring one up, or Priyank, do you have one there?
Yeah, I've got one. So this was, we touched on this last week, but this is now the finished version. And so Yogananda said, I experienced troubles of every kind and went through periods of greatest poverty. When we hadn't enough to buy food, we would fast for a few days. Then one day, it was in 1924, I knelt down and asked God and the masters, why have you brought me here to America? I felt that I was not fully accomplishing my mission, and I asked for their guidance. The answer came, and then a vision in which I saw myself in Los Angeles. That's one of the, so that was the time where he was obviously experiencing some significant hardships, and he, as he often does, resorted to deep prayer and seeking the answer from the eye of intuition or the clouds above.
There's something very powerful about that, isn't it? That he talks about it in the lessons to say, use your emotions, mix them with divinity in a sense, and they can be really powerful and bring about real change. And he's showing us the way really through reporting on that himself. Nice. And Mike, do you want to read the second one, chapter 21?
It's about when they were in India. So he says, we made a pilgrimage to the ancient Srinagar temple of Swami Shankara. As I gazed upon the mountain peak hermitage, standing bold against the sky, I fell into an ecstatic trance. A vision appeared of a hilltop mansion in a distant land. The lofty Shankara ashram before me was transformed into the structure where years later I established the Self-Realization Fellowship headquarters in America. When I first visited Los Angeles and saw the large building on the crest of Mount Washington, I recognized it at once from my long past visions in Kashmir and elsewhere. Yeah, he knew what he wanted. he just saw it already 20 years before or something. Amazing.
Yeah. So you must have to have such patience if you can see something so grand and awesome like this and going through the struggles that he did go through in some ways. So I'll read out this third one. I think we actually might have a sort of fourth instance, but I'll read this third one up for now. We touched on this in the last minute, actually. It was whenever in chapter 12 in the autobiography, when Yogananda was with Sri Yukteswar in his hermitage. Sri Yukteswar really came to Yogananda when Yogananda wasn't quite concentrating during one of his meditations, and said, your architectural dreams will materialize later. Now is the time for study. Thus, incidentally, my guru revealed in his simple way the coming of three great events in my life. Since early youth, I had enigmatic glimpses of three buildings, each in a different setting. In the exact sequence Sri Yukteswar had indicated, these visions took ultimate form. From first came my founding of a boys' yoga school on a ranchy plain, then my American headquarters on a Los Angeles hilltop, finally a hermitage in Southern California by the vast Pacific. Master never arrogantly asserted, and I love this bit of the text, Master never arrogantly asserted, I prophesy that such and such an event shall occur. He would rather hint, don't you think it may happen? But this his simple speech hid Vatic power. There was no recanting. Never did he slightly, did his slightly veiled words prove false. And it goes on to talk a little bit about, you know, true power that Sri Yukteswar had, that he never flaunted, never tried to attract people in with his ability to see the future. And it's just such an awesome part of the autobiography. Yeah, great. What are your thoughts on that, Priyank?
Yeah, so
on these visions.
The one thing I'd like to say, so even though he had these visions and he knew that these grand settings would be places for big events in his life, such as those that you just said, I don't think he would have known that where they were. So he wouldn't have, like, mm-hmm. you know, like Google Earth it, like you spin it and then you go points there. He wouldn't have had that that he would have just seen these visions, I'm imagining anyway. So then when he actually comes to these places, then he would have matched the vision to where he actually is. So mm-hmm. you know, and when he was in Boston and he realized that this isn't matching my vision, perhaps that is when he would have said, no, this isn't where I'm meant to be.
What do you think when he was in Ranchi and he was in that little room where he meditated and he had the vision and he said, Americans, those are Americans. Do you think he saw Boston or he saw LA?
Well, you would have seen American faces. So it could have been anywhere. Yeah.
That's true.
I don't know.
The fact that he saw those faces before, and when he, you know, so he's like always seeing the faces of people that were going to come into his life. And his intuition was just that powerful. That it could be so remote. I don't know how I would handle something like that, knowing it was going to be so many decades in the future, years in the future. I'd probably just blow it off personally. Like, whatever. It's like forever from now.
But to be fair, that's what he did, right? That's yeah. Like he kind of thought about it for a bit and then he was like, okay, but nothing I can do about it now. And he does this so often. Like he has like, he's like being told, oh, you're going to be sick. And they're like, oh yeah. And by the time I got sick, I had forgotten about his prophecy. And, you know, like if I get something like this, I would go like, I would think about it all the time. You know, I would be like,
yeah.
Quit work, leave home for the local mountains. But Mike, you raised a good point there. You know, the America, surely these people's Americans. I didn't actually know what that meant when I read it, but now that you're saying it, so the faces you would have seen would have been, you know, not just random people on the street, probably it would have been people that he would have initiated or recognized in this life from past life disciple guru disciple relationship. And we're going to talk about some of the important disciples he's met in this phase of it, in this very phase of his life a bit later.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we jump into the actual travel, the actual journey that I took. And again, Priyank, you've used Phil Goldberg's
well-researched
information.
So I've mapped it, yeah. So so what happened, so as we said last time, he traveled with a few people, three of them. Two of them were Americans, Arthur Kolmitter and Ralph Lubliner. And they were both devotees. So they had the privilege of going on this transcontinental trip with Guruji. And the other one was Muhammad Rashid, who he had met, as I mentioned last time, on the ship, the city of Sparta, and he was from Calcutta. So these are the four people that he traveled with. And he also, he had to travel obviously by car. So they actually purchased a car for this trip. And it was a Maxwell, if you guys know what that is. It's one of those old looking cars, but it would have, I did some maths and it would have cost $20,000 in today's money. So not an insignificant sum. But yeah, so he literally went across the continent, but he didn't go the straight line route. So he kind of, from New York, went to Philadelphia, then went to Colorado. That's the natural thing to do. But then you'd go through Colorado, Arizona, etc. But he didn't do that. He went up actually to through Yellowstone or Vancouver. And then he did this funny thing from Vancouver. He did Seattle and Vancouver. He did, for some reason, he decided to take the opportunity and do a cruise trip to Alaska. which obviously we know he's a big fan of traveling and seeing seeing the sights. And so he came, he did a cruise that, and looked around in Alaska, and he obviously compared it to the Kashmir, and he said both of them deserve the Queen's Prize for the most beautiful spots in the world. And then he went down to LA, but various things happened along that trip. So for example, in Seattle, he met Sister Gyanamata, one of the faces that we said that obviously is a very important figure in his life. And what happened there was her son went for a talk, and then the son was like, "You must come." And then she then went and met him. And then obviously the rest is history, as I said. I don't know if we'll talk about much about Sister Gyanamata later in this podcast, but obviously she's one of, Yogananda described her as probably one of her most advanced disciples. So that's pretty significant. And then, so then he went down to Oregon, and then apparently that was the first place that he had the first time he used healing affirmations in one of the halls there. And then he went to San Francisco and spent 2 months there, where he met Luther Burbank, of course, who he dedicated the supreme work of dedicating that supreme work, that is the autobiography of a yogi, to him. So he must have been a very special soul. And then he also met Laurie Pratt, who is Taramata. So he obviously met some important faces, and those were perhaps some of those American faces that he would have seen in his vision in that room in Ranchi, as Mike said. So he left on the 11th of July, 24, and got to LA in and around just before his, which birthday would have been in 1925, the 2nd of Jan, 1925. Whoever can do the maths, what birthday would that have been? 32. So yeah, just before his 32nd birthday, he got to LA. So there's a big history trip trivia for you. And then, and as I say, as I mentioned, they were camping. A lot of the places they were camping. So guys, why do you think he did this odd trip and not just the straight southern route as most people do to try and get there the quickest way? Anyone?
We talked.
Go on, Josh.
You're probably the best person to talk about this, Josh. Maybe.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of speculation. I think the devotees around him at that time would know really the best, especially the close disciples, because they were very much in tune with him. And so, being in tune with him, you probably understood his mindset, maybe just that much better. But there's also the fact that maybe a lot of the roads now that are developed, like, I don't even know if the I-10 was a thing in 1920s. I mean, where it might be really practical to just head south and then cut east or cut west, you know, it might not be so practical in the 1920s. So I'm really not sure of the landscape. But, you know, as somebody, if just trying to put myself in Guruji's shoes, if I came with a mission, I'm going to cover as much ground as I can. And so if you take a direct route west, then you may miss people, miss things, or, you know, not reach as wide of an audience. So there's probably a little bit of him guiding the intuition, but then also the lay of the land is kind of guiding him at the same time. He's thinking like, okay, well, where can I speak? Where is there going to be an auditorium? So, okay, I'll travel over here and give a talk, and then I'll travel over here. You know, so there's kind of probably a little bit of this opposing action of his own intuition, but also just the way that things are constructed at this time. And that's how I imagine it, but who knows? I mean, it's all speculation.
What about the racism in the southern states, Mike, back then?
Yeah, go for it, Josh.
Well, he braved that like nobody else. I mean, he was a graceful human being. I mean, I've heard plenty of times where he would be told that he couldn't go into a restaurant because it wouldn't serve colored people. And he would just say, all right, there's plenty of room in this town for all of us. And they would go somewhere else. You know, whereas other people who were with him wanted to get angry, wanted to fight, wanted to argue. And that wasn't his nature. So there's a lot of courage in a person coming to a foreign land, knowing that you're not going to be maybe necessarily accepted as well. But I don't think that even slowed him down or impeded him in the slightest. I mean, not until at least it had to. I mean, I heard the story in Awake about what, I mean, I don't mean to get off minute because I know we're talking about a specific minute, but I know he had a pretty bad experience out here in Florida. But Florida in the 1920s is very different than Florida in 2021. I really hardly doubt he would experience anything remotely like what he experienced then today.
Yes, I think Josh touched on some really good points there. One definitely that the South back then was also a it wasn't as industrialized as it is now. I think the Interstate Highway Act was enacted in 1955, six, something like that. So there were really no freeways that would go to everywhere you wanted to go, right? Mm-hmm. The racism, I mean, I can totally understand that because the South was still segregated at this point, right? So if he wanted to stay in a hotel, he couldn't stay in a hotel where white people would stay. Same thing with restaurants. I'm not sure how it would be with venues, and it would be more difficult, would probably take some extra preparation and extra hard work. And so that's probably one reason why he didn't go there in the beginning. And then in the West, one must say also that Texas, Arizona, those weren't the places back then that they are now. They were much, much less populated at that time, including California. I mean, California already had San Francisco, which was a meaningful city. And I guess that might also be a reason why he went there. And then, I mean, Priyang already said in Seattle and Oregon, and also in San Francisco, he met some devotees, some people who followed him later. So maybe he was drawn to them as well. Could also be a reason.
Quickly on that, on the fact that he was drawn to those devotees. So the importance of those devotees, I don't think can be underestimated, because we know the significance of those devotees in his life, but also, you know, Master or Brother Nandaboy, one of his talks says like many of us are handpicked by the guru for certain elements of his work. I think that's in the talk about loyalty. And Luther Burbank, for example, he died in 1926, so only a year or two after their first meeting. But later, Yogananda apparently was in New York when he died, and he got the news. And he describes his grief in his memoir: "Locking myself away from secretaries and visitors, I spent the next 24 hours in seclusion. The following day, he conducted a traditional Vedic ritual for his friend." So can you imagine, Guruji, if you passed away, spending 24 hours of, the life he's led and the amount of activity he's done, just locking himself away, canceling his all meetings and just meditating on, or whatever he was doing during those 24 hours, just staggering, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think do you want to go, Josh?
No, I was just
agreeing. Okay. I feel like Luther Burbank, like he was like a really heart-opening figure for Yogananda. I mean, after giving lectures to like Wall Street bankers for like 3-4 years on the East Coast, like it must have been like a breath of fresh air to meet like this guy who at one occasion he called an American yogi, he called an American saint, and he was really enjoying his company. And like Luther Burbank lived in Santa Rosa, which is not around the corner from LA really. That's like a 10-hour drive in today, our freeways that we have today. So I'm not sure how long it took back then. And he said he made this trip often, and also talked a lot about his work, and his work was really significant. Like I heard about Luther Burbank in other contexts than SRF, how meaningful he was for the American agricultural industry, how before the early 1900s, people wouldn't eat any vegetables really. People would have diets that were even to our standards today, very bad. And he started making a lot of crops that in a way that they would grow bigger or give fruits earlier and things like that. And Guruji mentions that a few times in the autobiography, and he really admired Luther Burbank. And that's why I think he made a big deal when he passed on and gave him a big send off.
A couple of other funny stories, if I may. about his trip that we found out. Apparently, as there was one harrowing, really harrowing moment, as they were driving one night, a wheel fell off the axle and rolled away. Several hundred pounds of luggage were scattered through the brush as we careened and jolted to a stop. And while Arthur and Ralph walked up the road to find help, the others searched for and found the errant wheel. Jorgrande said he got it back on the axle himself, and they were back on the highway before the other drivers had returned with the mechanic.
I'll be waiting for them.
I've got to go meet Luther Burbank. No, I'm sure he did wait. And the other thing was to do his cruise to Alaska and look at Alaska, he had to go cross the border and go into Vancouver. And apparently to get the visa to go into Canada was quite an experience. And like the guy wasn't giving him the visa, and they were having that like similar scenario to when he was coming to America and trying to get his visa. That was pretty funny. But it was pretty good. I'll just read out what happened. Apparently he was told to return the following day after the argument, and he wouldn't issue the visa. And he said he did, bringing with him one of his books and a copies of his poems. Calling the rude immigrant officer, "Sir," he assured him that he never swallowed swords or tamed cobras like other of India's street magicians. As for his turban, he pointed out that he has seen many hypocritical Westerners wearing hats and dresses and suits, but does not associate hypocrisy with hats. You cannot expect all Hindus to forsake turbans because some Hindus are far from exemplary, he said. Just as I do not expect all Western brothers to forsake their hats because some have practiced hypocrisy whilst wearing their hats. Decrying the arrogance of Westerners who think Indians had to wear swallowtail coats and neckties to be civilized, he added, customs and mannerisms are non-essentials resulting from certain climatic influences. The real development of man consists of the development of his mind power. This chastened official, he says, promptly processed the visa.
Wow.
Talk about preparing for a meeting.
Wonder if he used his mind powers beyond that, but it sounds like he just used his sweet words.
Which, yeah.
There is the route went from, you know, from east to west, but really pivoted quite heavily, you know, from heading west to sort of northwest at Colorado, didn't it, in Denver. And there's a great little story there as well. Shall I read that?
Yeah, go for it. Quickly,
So in recalling the events leading up to their departure, Yogananda said, "There was only enough money left to last until we reached Denver. But as would happen often in his life, the need was quickly met. At a farewell dinner in his honor, the hostess, whom he does not name, took him aside. I cannot do very much for you," she said, "but please accept this." She gave him a check for $7,000. Assuming he remembered the number correctly, the gift amounted to nearly $100,000 in 2017 money. "Behind it, I saw the hand of God," said Yogananda. I was so overcome, tears of gratitude flowed, and I predicted to her, "You will see a large institution in Los Angeles as a result of this check." There you go. Wow. Another prediction.
Well, there you go. LA.
That's money well spent. Money well spent, right?
Yeah.
And she said, "I cannot do much for you." What? humble.
Yeah, humble, I suppose, would be the word.
Imagine the karma you get for writing this check. Yeah.
you're buying a lot of karma coupons. And then he went to Denver, right? And then he just kind of went north and kind of cut across. And, you know, to your point, Josh, maybe going living by intuition.
Because that's the inflection point in the journey. Like, he kind of cuts across. He's going through these Midwest states. And then he goes to Colorado, and then he just shoots north. So, yeah, that is kind of a unique portion of the journey.
He's avoiding Utah. which he goes there later to find Dayama and
Their family. It's not time for Dayamata yet. Can't go there. Yeah. She would seek me out too soon. She would have been a bit younger, wouldn't she?
She would have been like 15 or something. Much younger, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Awesome. is there anything else in there?
Just one quick one, actually. So when he went to San Francisco, he apparently stayed in a place called the Palace Hotel, which was one of the grandest hotels in California and one of the largest ever built at the time. And apparently the Palace retained a professional photographer named Hugo Schreiber, whose job was to photograph distinguished guests. One of Schreiber's shots of Yogananda came to be known as the standard pose, which is behind me, and it can be seen in homes of altars and centers of Yogananda's around the world. So not to mention the millions of bookshelves that cover his autobiography. So during that trip and the 2 months that he spent in San Francisco, that is where this beautiful photo was taken of the standard pose, as we call it now.
Amazing.
Very nice. Very nice. I think my internet connection is just dropping in. If I do cut off, just jump in.
Will do.
I wanted just to move on. You know, in the minute, we have lots of images and cool photos and being shared. Giving us a real feel for what life would have been like back then, but also gives us great images of Yogananda, arriving in the car with his two companions, and then auditoriums. And we hear from Vernon Sunny that he filled out an auditorium to double its capacity to 6,000 people for one night, I believe that was. And that's a pretty spectacular number, just to look at 600,000 people living there. You've got 1% of them showing up in the first night. And then he goes on to do a 7-night series, talking for 7 nights in a row when he landed in the LA Philharmonic Auditorium. So, he really makes a big splash when he lands. So he must have been the talk of the town. If you've got a few percent of the people in a city really going to see you, it's pretty crazy, isn't it? And that's, he must have really felt like he really landed. He's really arrived, and he's able to reach so many people.
On that point of him being landed, apparently when he first came to LA, he stayed in the Biltmore Hotel. So he landed, and he no doubt would have foreseen where he was going to depart from from the exact location that he was going to depart, because that's obviously where he took his Mahasamadhi on that famous Eve of 1952, I believe, was it? So some 30 years forward from that point. Sorry, Chris, interrupted you.
No, it's good. Pretty good info. Was that in the Phil Goldberg's book?
Everything. All my knowledge is from there, apparently. Now, having said that, the Denver guys, you guys should check out the Denver SRF Center website. They've got some fantastic history and images of this trip and information about some of these stories that we talk about.
Cool.
Yeah, and I think a takeaway for me looking at this was the initiative. This is what Masvidal really talks about here in the final sort of coming seconds of last seconds of the minute. Masvidal says, if I can bring it up, that he knew the power of initiative. He didn't wait for anybody to get his wisdom out there, and he sent his lessons out via mail. And this at the time was the new thing to do. And there's a great little picture that they have on the minute, where you can have your different ways of sending post, and one of them was by air, by a special air or airplane, and it was 16 cents, I think it was, or 24 cents at the time. So that would have been a lot more in today's money, obviously, but a very new thing, and Yogananda embraced it. I just wanted to ask, actually, the power of initiative. Yogananda is really breaking new ground here at a time when it's the very first time it's possible in human history for us. What lessons really can we take of this in our day and age? Josh, I'll come to you for this one. You know, the idea that Yogananda's coming in and bringing a very ancient tradition, culture, and teaching, and you teaching, and he's coming in and really shaking it up and using the mail order service to send out his lessons. Like, what lessons can we take from that today?
You know, I mean, I look at Brother Chidananda and all he's doing now, and that's what I really think about is we have all this new technology, all these ways of communicating, and Brother Chidananda comes in and he's coming up with these ways of keeping SRF in the 21st century and keeping us all connected and still able to, you know, get through things like pandemics and hold on to our spiritual routines and still be immersed even when, you know, these group gatherings are impossible. And so, you know, I mean, how this ties in with the initiative, I don't know, but Yogananda was exemplary of that. I know that much. And I guess it's just, there's a lot of surrender and the way that I think Yogananda embraced his path in life. But I don't know.
Mike. Mike, what's your thoughts on this?
Initiative is your middle name, isn't it, Mike?
Mike, initiative. It's
one of the qualities that Guruji talks a lot about in his teachings, right? If you go over the lessons, but you also can look into some of the booklets that he has, the power of success, and he describes lack of initiative as a mental disease. So the lack of the things that are in your mind that your mind wants to manifest, you're not doing it, that is hindering you on your path. So, and he was the complete opposite. He was like, I mean, he also had to, if you think about it, he came to this new land to establish his organization. None of the things that he did would have happened without him, right? So this whole movement was completely driven by his initiative. So he probably did things that people around him didn't understand every single day, every single hour, right? This whole doing everything by his intuition. I mean, imagine you are one of his devotees, you meet him in Boston, and then he takes you on a road trip cross country without any money. And he goes like, oh yeah, Divine Mother is gonna guide us and she will find money for us. And I mean, it must be really something you need to be the self-realized yogi to do. And it's exemplary. And of course, a big role model for us.
Nice. Priyank.
Yeah, it was a good point you were asking about, because, you know, he had this mission. Deshra said, you'll go to America, Lee Marshai, you know, your devotee, you'll go, Mahathir Babaji, you know, he's got this mission, but they didn't give him the means or the way to do it. For all of that, he had to use his initiative. So all he had from them was, this is the place on the map, go somewhere around here and work out how to get there. When you're there, work out how to stay there. When you're there, whilst you're there, work out how to establish this worldwide organization. So literally all they did was gave him like the smallest snippet of inspiration, and the rest he had to use his initiative for. And yeah, I totally agree with Mike said about lack of initiative being a disease. And I relate this to our workplace, like, and this applies for all walks of life, doesn't it? So, you know, you always have those people in your teams at work which don't use their initiative. They have to be spoon-fed. And then that is just like the worst team in history, isn't it? When some parts of the team have to be spoon-fed. I mean, like, you can't be afraid to do things wrong. You just have to do things. You have to take your initiative to do it. And taking your initiative and doing it wrong and learning from it is far better than being spoon-fed the right way of doing it and then having to be spoon-fed for the rest of your life. I mean, what sort of sedentary life is that you're going to lead?
Yeah. He was given the keys, wasn't he? Even to with the work that he did on the Gita by Sri Yukteswar. Like, he wasn't given the answers, wasn't it? Was he? He had to use his own initiative of power of wisdom and perception and perceive his own truth and find his own way. So yeah, awesome. And there was a lovely letter from Sri Yukteswar. Was that actually, I see that, you know, behind the scenes kind of cut here, the card has been moved to minute 31. Is that accidental or was that on purpose?
No, that was on purpose because that relates heavily to the establishment of the next minute, actually minute 31. Okay. That's why I moved it. Going back to his the Gita and some of the talks that he did and the initiative that he used, so he called himself for his talks, he called himself a representative of the Maharaja of Kasim Bazar, Bengal, India. So that, you know, to a completely random Westerner, that's gonna, of one of those tens of thousands of people that would have listened to it or gone to his talk, you know, they would have read things about, you know, using your willpower and all that kind of stuff that he called the talks and life force, and then they would have read that, you know, representative of Maharaja, they wouldn't know who this guy is, obviously. But the fact that that's there just goes, oh yeah, actually there, I'll go to that. It's like this bit of expert marketing, isn't it? And you know, we didn't before, we said, like, I hate it when people use the word like guru inappropriately. Marketing guru is a common one, but in this respect, this is the marketing guru of the highest caliber, isn't it? An actual guru and a marketing guru.
Yeah, he was poetic as well, right? He had such mastery over the English language and could convey information so effortlessly. So yeah. Not surprised at all. He was able to take to marketing like a fish to water.
Yeah, I think that's something we touched on earlier with the airmail, right? That he was like, he came to America and he didn't think, oh, I'm gonna use my methods that I learned in India here. That he was like, no, how are people doing things here? And I'm gonna use those methods to spread my message. And he was super effective at this because he learned the American way pretty quickly. And whenever he saw a new technology and that could help advance his cause, he would jump on it. And that is something that, like, if you look at it so many years later, you go like, okay, yeah, he used airmail, but that airmail only existed for a few years back then. That's like something if you put it into context, that's what Masvidal does. It's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to have to rename this podcast minute, The Power of Initiative. That's our takeaway.
Done, let's do it.
So, awesome. With that, gents, anything more that you would like to add? Anything we missed on?
I have one thing. Just quickly, there was a reporter that offered praise, muted praise for Yogananda's speaking style from his early days when he was there. And he said, his language and oratory are void of frills, for which his manifest sincerity makes ample amends, and contrasted his scientific approach with the exhibitionist yogis of India. In a remark that might not have sat well with mainstream clerics, he added this denouement: this is a practical message which Christian preachers might well adopt to teach self-made happiness. For the Swami teaches and demonstrates that God is within us. The seed of happiness lies within the frame of the individual. It merely needs connection of spiritual wires to bring out spiritual power, snatched from the universal cosmic energy to pour into the stagnant and inactive cells of the physical body, which is the image of God. So that was
where was that from again?
Well, that's from the biography, but I don't know where the article was from, actually.
Okay. Very nice.
Can't beat that.
Yeah, yes. as an endorsement, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well written. Lovely. Thank you for sharing that, Priyank. Josh, anything more from you? Would you want to add any comments?
I mean, on theme with everything, I don't know. I mean, but it's been quite illuminating to hear all this stuff because, you know, I'm hearing stuff about his journey here that I never even heard before. You know, but you learn so much. There was times where I got to see some. I have met a couple of people who knew Yogananda personally, in my life. And you hear so many fascinating stories. I met a nun or a former nun who actually was on the path when he was around and got to listen to her and her stories about him. I mean, it's everything we've said and then some, you know. I don't think I could add anything more brilliantly said than what Priyank just read, but you know, it's just beautiful to always kind of be able to see more and learn more from these different perspectives.
Awesome. Thank you very much for your time today. Josh, thanks for joining us. Do come back.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely having you.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone.
Take care.